Friends, hello and welcome to the second ever mailbag episode for Never Post. That's very exciting. That's fun stuff. Yeah. Can we go around the mailbag that we are all here inside of?
Yeah. It's so dark in here. I'm
just
so scared.
Who is joining us on the call? Hi, it's me, Mike. I'm here.
Hi, Mike. It's me, Jason, executive producer.
Hi, Jason. It's me, Hans, senior producer.
Hi, Hans. It's me, Georgia, producer.
So nice in here. So cozy inside the mailbag. So in the mailbag, if you didn't listen to the first one, we respond to listener comments in the form of emails, comments on the website, voice memos that were left for us via the Airtable, and voicemails left at our phone number. And to get things started, we are going to hear a voicemail from someone who reached out about things in episode zero, which was our independent media roundtable. And Violet had this to say.
I never post. I'm Violet, she, her. My ears perked up when anarchism was mentioned during the conversation in the mailbag episodes 1 through 3 episode, during the conversation regarding the limits of the cooperative structure. And I wanted to expand on the discussion from that perspective. In organizing, especially anarchist organizing, there's a concept that affinity groups should be exactly as big as necessary to accomplish a very specific task that they need to do. So in this context, instead of one large cooperative, there would instead be an interconnected network of smaller, democratically organized cooperative teams who could work together, each with their own objective that forms a piece of the larger goal that the entire team of teams has. These groups could be federated by things like mutual membership between the groups or a committee with members elected from each team. Now, how these concepts interact with currently existing business law, I couldn't say, but I think it is important to remain imaginative in regards to how to structure a more democratic workplace and the world in general. Thank you.
Okay, so number one, hell yeah.
Hell
can
yeah.
I just, hell yeah. Uh-huh.
Everyone else, please respond to everything else we do with anarchist theory.
This was responding to something that Jason said, which was itself a summary of something that we had talked about that I think did not make its way into the final edit of the independent media roundtable, which is that trying to organize organizations. So trying to figure out how it is that you work together and not just alongside one another when you are working in an industry of separate independent media entities has a lot of the same characteristics of doing the kind of organizing that Violet is talking about. Which is like, how do you invite people into your bespoke structure for the way that you work while still maintaining trust, while making sure that you're doing things the way that you want to do, the way that they want to do, but you're all still working towards shared goals across all of these, you know, the way Violet talks about them, their affinity groups, we're thinking about them in the perspective, from the perspective of media companies, essentially.
Yeah.
And I really mainly wanted to play this and put it out there for the vote, the plus one, the thumbs up of like how important it is to remain imaginative. I love that so, so much. And I think it's so important. And I just, yeah. Love also that it's episode zero, which means it comes at the top of this mailbag. So it's the first thing that everybody's hearing.
And this is something that I deeply want to keep talking about while we make this show. We are trying to make something that is owned and operated by us that can exist in this world without needing to create hierarchy as we scale, where you almost necessarily take advantage of others and somehow funded enough to survive. I want to keep talking about how we can accomplish that. And we certainly need to be creative. And I want to hear from everybody else who is trying to do the same thing, because we all need to find a way to make it work.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear.
Hell yeah.
All right. Moving on from episode zero, we are now moving to episode one. And we got an email from Pinelli, who is a high school teacher, responding to the teen fashion segment, which was a segment where Georgia talked to Professor Wissinger about why tween girls dress like their moms.
Pennelly had a really interesting point here, which is, as they describe it, the Zoom uniform. So basically, having something presentable up top, and then for bottoms, basically pajamas or sweatpants. So this very much specifically looking at teens, tweens, people who are in school during the last couple of years, so in the heart of the pandemic. And I find this very interesting because, as Pennelly said, this fashion then kind of translated to actual school when these students returned to school, that they're sort of offering the same fashion that they were presenting over Zoom, but in real life. And that creates this funny tension. And I imagine we're going to see even more of this. The last couple of years have influenced tweens' relationship to their own clothing in a really profound way. I mean, I was just talking to a friend about how Gen Z, and I'm guessing even now like Gen Alpha, are fully obliterating the interest in wearing heels, like at all, which I love personally, but is, I think, very much a part of the last couple of years being like, why would I wear heels? I am not leaving my house.
No one sees my feet on the internet.
Well,
not for free.
Well, unless you
not for free. We're talking about anarchism and we're talking about feet.
This is an internet podcast.
This is a good show. We make a good show.
Yeah, this totally tracks. I mean, it has changed the way I dress as an adult. The lockdown, why would it not change everyone else in the way they dress?
Well, it's interesting because Pennelly says specifically that the technologically determined difference in look between, like, the, you know, using the equator of the waist, the two different hemispheres of look, seems to have permeated throughout one age group. But she says specifically, I don't generally see women my age in that look. Yeah. And I wonder if that's just like habit, right? You have memories of the before times.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you still have TikToks coming up of women, millennial women, being like, I don't know how to not wear skinny jeans. And the children are making fun of me.
Got it. Like, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Also, let's be fair, pajama pants in school were a thing.
Oh, we were, yeah,
growing up as well. And it's not just because Dave Matthews was doing it on stage and that seemed very cool. I assume that's where it came from.
Oh, it's a bad podcast now. Now we're making a bad podcast.
People just like wearing pajamas. All right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have the whole culture of like Cookie Monster pajamas girl.
That's a whole new can.
Yeah. I don't think that's essentially unusual.
Right.
But I think the purpose of it, the sort of reasoning, the context behind it is so specific now.
And maybe we're just seeing the light. Maybe Cookie Monster pajama pants girl was right the whole time.
Oh, my God.
Also in episode one, we had Posting Disease, a discussion that I had with Bijan Steven about people who cannot stop themselves from posting, even though it's bad for them. We got a voicemail from Aaron about Posting Disease with some interesting thoughts.
I never post people. The way he describes Posting Disease, i.e. that you start thinking of the world in terms of posting and the posts that you can make about it, is exactly like the Tetris effect, another famous screen time induced illness in scare quotes. And I'd be interested to hear what y'all think of that as a notion.
So just for background, I'm going to read the first couple sentences of the Tetris effect Wikipedia entry. The Tetris effect occurs when someone dedicates vast amounts of time, effort, and concentration on an activity, which thereby alters their thoughts, experiences, dreams, and so on. The term originates from the popular video game Tetris. People who have played Tetris for a prolonged amount of time find themselves thinking about ways different shapes in the real world can fit together, such as the boxes on a supermarket shelf or the buildings on a street.
Mm. Ooh.
It freaks
or famously,
me out.
When you dream or shut your eyes and the little boxes just
keep going.
I think these are the same thing. Yes, I think that they are, Aaron, I think this is extremely perceptive and I 100% agree. And I want to extend it by saying this is a great way of thinking about how social media is designed as a game. And for anybody who has read Addiction by Design, like, that's on purpose. Like, it is put together so that you want to engage in activities that add to the stack of things in the world that then give you points and attention, and you get to see number go up, and you get to have other people reinforce the fact that you contributed was good. And it all just feels very similar to the satisfaction of Tetris. Mm. It is very similarly satisfying, though, you know, it's like, Bijan has said this to me, posting on social media a lot of the times is like being really thirsty while you're stranded in the ocean and you're just looking at salt water and you're like, I'm just so thirsty. Mm-hmm. How bad could it be?
What if it's fine? Yeah. What if it's fine this time?
I mean, I won't be the one to get thirsty. Other people might get more thirsty.
I personally will probably be quenched by salt water.
Of course.
It's simply because I'm built different.
No, I was thinking about this very recently of filtering through things happening in my life as ways I could post about them. Something innocuous happens, I'm like, oh, well, if I post about it, I could like say this and I could post like this and blah, blah, blah. Mm. Like, it's so, like, I don't even realize I'm thinking about it.
When I used to post 12 times a day for I Love Charts, most of those posts had little captions under them that were just my two cents on something. And at the time, I caught myself looking at things and captions would spring to mind. The little pithy thing that I would say to set this just right in the mind of the viewer. I don't like it, but it's gone now. So I'm fixed.
We're trapped in a cage of pithiness forever.
Yeah. Moving on to episode 3, James McKenzie sent us an email about Georgia and Tamara's segment about how the infrastructure of social media does, like, mostly doesn't support the process of grieving and mourning. And there's one thing that James said that I thought was really interesting that I would love to hear your reaction to, Georgia. And he writes, the analogy I keep returning to is saying goodbye to a loved one at the airport, getting on a plane. Pre-1990s, that was it. Now you can keep calling and texting that person up to and sometimes including the time they're on a plane. The communication only definitively stops when the plane takes off and lands, the aerial equivalent of entering a tunnel, I guess. The anxiety of separation never reaches the same height. Digital spaces and communication facilitate or allow so much management of it that something about the experience feels lost. I wonder how others feel about this. Hmm. If they find themselves struggling, not just when separated from a loved one, but separated from communicating with them. What else is lost besides the connection? Which is an interesting thought of, like, you know, we're like out of practice. James goes on to say this, like, out of practice being away from people. Mm-hmm. And in a way, when people persist online after their death, there are ways in which that withness, that communication can continue just with no return, obviously.
And later in James's message, he also mentions that being online and grieving online makes that process so much more public than it may have been in other situations, in other contexts. And that can cause frustration and tension to people who maybe are also part of this process of grieving, but are seeing this prolonged expression of it and are like uncomfortable by it, are made uncomfortable. And it is just putting all of that in a public space that it kind of isn't normally set for. It's not suited for normally. We don't expect it.
Yeah, I think the public availability of that timeline of grief is a big challenge here. You see it in places where there's losses in communities and the community does something publicly to note the loss of someone, the passing of someone. I'm thinking about like YouTube communities. I'm thinking about battle rap specifically, actually, where different companies will put on title cards at the beginning of their releases saying, rest in peace, this person who was taken too early, et cetera, et cetera. And then at a certain point, it is years after the fact, and do they still put up that title card? And that's a thing that people have opinions about. When have you sufficiently mourned for long enough? And now that we're all involved in the discussion about that, it makes it so much more challenging to figure out what is a sufficient mourning period for you, for others, for your public facing self, for your private self. What a wildly complicated space to just try to do one of the more difficult human experiences. It's tough.
On to episode 4. First, we're going to talk about critical ignoring, which was a segment that Hans produced about why it is paying attention to all of the news makes us feel exhausted. And one way of addressing that, which has to do with just not paying attention to a bunch of stuff if you can.
Yeah. One of the really interesting first questions that we got was from John, who let us know that he worked at Twitter 2014 to 2017 in trust and safety. So that's a big time fighting disinformation, abuse, terrorism, all that stuff. That's a pretty important time to have done that work. And the thing that John wants to introduce into the conversation on critical ignoring is the Dunning-Kruger effect, which I had to look up to make sure that I understood it. If you don't know, Psychology Today describes it as a cognitive bias in which people wrongly overestimate their knowledge or ability in a specific area. It tends to occur because a lack of self-awareness prevents them from accurately assessing their own skills. What John is saying is maybe it's actually more like work. And he provides us with a sample script. So, Georgia, will you, will you help me with this script that we have here?
Yes.
So John says that someone will join the Twitter Trust and Safety team and say something like,
"Happy to join the team and finally fight the Nazis. Twitter has historically been bad at this. Good thing I'm here."
And then they would go on to suggest things.
"Have we considered this super basic idea? Oh, we have? Huh. What did we learn? Oh. Have we tried this other thing? We did? Oh. Huh."
Okay.
Thank you.
Bravo.
Yes.
Way to go. Bravo.
Amazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
A plus O, A plus plus plus, huh?
Thank you so much.
We submitted this and said, huh, I wonder what Dr. Stephen Lewandowski, the guest in this segment, would have to say about this. And he had some thoughts.
The Dunning-Kruger effect is a serious issue when it comes to people making comments about things they don't understand, except they think they do. I think that this doesn't apply quite as much to critical ignoring, because the cost of ignoring something mistakenly, I think, is quite low. There's lots of things out there we can look at. And if there's a few we don't look at, even though maybe we should have, I think the loss function for that is far less than it is for mistakenly spreading information, thinking you know what you're talking about, but you don't.
So it seems like Stephen has faith in people's ability to discern whether they have ignored something or whether they think they know enough about something, which is just a great deal of grace towards humanity that I perhaps don't share.
But I think there is a nugget in here that, if I'm understanding what he's saying correctly, I think I agree with, which is sort of the almost the theme of the show, which is that, like, it doesn't cost anything to shut up.
It
costs nothing to not contribute. And contrary to what many, many, many entities and people and organizations online want you to believe, you do not have to contribute and probably shouldn't contribute to every conversation.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that that actually leads us really well into the next question that we got from Josh from Palo Alto, who talks about the commodification and the way that you actually have to use these things, which is kind of what Stephen is saying.
Howdy, Never Posters. I wanted to point you at an excellent take from media theorist Shaked Spear. He suggests that the overwhelmingness of being blasted with world news 24/7 doesn't really have to do with the volume of information there. We're always ignoring mountains of raw data from our environment all the time without getting frazzled. Like, the color of the ceiling or the number of leaves on a nearby plant are technically available and knowable, but they're not useful, so we don't feel overwhelmed by missing out on them. Speer thinks that we feel this way because we're engaging in a sort of commodity fetishism with information products, mistaking the consumption of information-shaped things for learning and integrating useful facts into our mental framework for action. Like, I might read a half dozen articles over breakfast, but if I don't or can't incorporate them into an actionable mental model of the world, I might as well be counting leaves or staring at the ceiling. We do pick up on vibes, but if we don't come up with a plan to act and fix whatever's causing them, then the only thing to do with that nervous energy is read something else or maybe post about having consumed it. Anyway, bye.
That rules. Josh rules. Our listeners rule. This is so much fun.
Huge Josh fans in the chat right now.
I'm fans of this whole thing. Did we get something from Steven on this too?
You know, we actually did. He had some thoughts.
We're so lucky.
That's an interesting point, because it is true that we're constantly being bombarded with information. You know, I'm looking out the window right now and there's like, you know, trees and cows and paddocks, all sorts of things. And I don't feel overwhelmed by that. So why is critical ignoring such a big deal? I think it's because when it comes to information that isn't natural and that isn't, you know, horses and leaves and trees out in the paddock, we're much more likely to become overwhelmed because they require more processing. It's easy enough to ignore things in the natural world, but it is not easy to ignore text, video, people talking to us. And that is where critical ignoring comes in. So we can filter out things even when they're challenging to us and they're demanding our attention.
I really think the additional aspect of this is like what Aaron said, which is that it's additionally so, so difficult to ignore this sorts of information when you are receiving it in a context that then insists you do something with it, but yeah, doesn't tell you what that thing is. No. You just yes know generally that it all has a use and it could be used to make you more popular or like more notable or make you yeah seem smart or whatever.
Yeah. It's a really pernicious mix of you're going to need this and people are going to love you for having this.
Yeah. So do something with it. Whereas yeah like looking at trees, I'm not thinking to myself like, well, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah.
I'm peeping these leaves and it's in my brain now. And now I'm going to have to figure out what to do with this. Damn it.
It's social currency. Use it.
Thank you to Steven for all the responses, for coming back and sending us thoughts from apparently the field near his house. What a delight.
And I have a thank you, which is to Hans for joining us for the first part of this mailbag, which we have yeah to say goodbye to Hans for the second half.
Bye,
which
Hans.
We're all sad about.
Get out of the bag.
Bye, y'all. Have fun.
Thank you. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Hansless, sad, but with more listener comments, which we're excited to talk about.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back, and I would like to, I think we said that we were going to establish this in the last episode, and I think in the last mailbag, and I think we may continue to do it for as long as we have material to work with. We have entered Molly's Corner, in which
I love
we answer
here
a really not show-related question/comment from my wife, Molly. And Jason, this one concerns you personally.
Uh-oh.
I just wanted to document a dare I've commissioned to Jason Oberholzer, inspired by some books he found in his parents' house. Tom Swift series, ever heard of it? No, me neither. Anyway, I've asked him to go into an innocuous setting and give the name Tom Swift, instead of his own, a coffee order, a restaurant reservation. They don't need to know who you are legally. I want video of the situation. I need Jason on camera. What I'm really trying to capture is this moment of embarrassment and gleeful joy, I assume he'll feel, when giving the name. And that's it. I just wanted more accountability for Jason, really, why I'm letting you all know. I mean, feel free to mention it to him. Call him Don't Twist My Act. I mean, have fun with it, you know? That's it. Thanks, bye.
Okay. Okay. More accountability is what I needed for this.
I didn't know she could just do dares on us.
Molly's corner is really getting aggressive. Yes, I found some books in my parents' house. Tom Swift books, which are, I mean, I don't know. I should look it up. 1950s classic boys science fiction books. The two titles I have, and I have not seen if all titles are like this, are Tom Swift's Possessive Something, Tom Swift's Spaceship, Tom Swift's Robot. I don't know if all of his things are so colonizer focused, but Molly really wanted me to go and order things in the world as Tom Swift and see if it made me feel good, I suppose. And also wanted this documented and has now enlisted all of the listeners in this pursuit.
Yes.
Tom Swift's mocha latte.
That is how I will do it. It is my right as Tom Swift to have this mocha latte. I don't know. I mean, what are interstitials in our show for, if not this?
There you go.
So
yeah,
get
perfect.
Ready for pristine binaural audio of Tom Swift.
And his many incredible adventures.
Yeah, asking for what's his.
Returning to episode 4, we had the segment about important emails and the weight of certain messages. And I just want to respond en masse to all of the communications we got that said that Georgia was correct.
Yes.
Texting from a computer is far superior.
Yes.
And that Georgia is right.
Vindication. I'm T-posing right now.
You actually are.
Wait, Georgia is dabbing. Georgia is just dabbing. Back and just constant. Oh my God.
Georgia's is in a backflip?
She's done at least a dozen dabs, everybody. Now she's dabbing on her cat?
Beefcake.
He just hit the dab. No, oh my God.
No, Beefcake is dabbing?
Turn away, Beefcake. You don't want to end up like this. I think universal, ubiquitous support for Georgia.
This is huge for me.
Every manner of communication possible.
I'm beaming. I'm so happy.
I mean, we all agreed with you. We were just aghast that someone would say it out loud.
Yeah.
Well, let the record show that I was always right.
Yeah, and not afraid to say it.
No.
So our first specific listener response that we will get to in the subject matter of important emails is from Mary Rose Devine, who asks some questions about other types of things that you can do, that you can compose on both phones and computers.
An email strikes me as something that's actionable. I actually feel the same way about long texts that I do about email, where anything that feels like I really need to dial in and create a task list or devote more than 10 minutes or so to, I have to be in my computer headspace to address. If I get a work text that has instructions for me, I'll almost always answer that on my computer. It's like a physical switch, computer out, notebook out, calendar out, got my workspace ready. This also carries over to any sort of editing project. So this is actually a reverse question for you. Even though there are currently some really great phone editing tools out there now for video, audio, images, which are maybe tailored better to social video and phone capabilities, I still always end up using like Premiere Pro, Audition, whatever. I would sooner take a video with my phone and send it over to my computer to edit and then put it back on my phone to upload, then use what is maybe a more tailored app and keep it all in my phone space. You all have backgrounds in audio and video. Have your workspaces stayed on the computer, or do you ever use or consider using some of those more mobile products?
So, I mean, I am curious to hear what you all say. None of us are like TikTokers, you know, like we're not making a lot of short form video,
right?
Mobile short form video and uploading it to YouTube Shorts or to TikTok or whatever, to, you know, making an Instagram reel. I've talked to a lot of people just professionally who are, and there are a lot of people that I've spoken to who are like, yeah, I do everything in CapCut, or like I do everything in the editor in TikTok. And every time I have tried to do that, I have thought to myself, I'm going to go insane if I keep doing this. And I have done exactly what Mary Rose Devine describes. I use DaVinci Resolve. I would always rather cut something in DaVinci Resolve than use whatever the built-in mobile editor is.
So I will use the features in the iPhone to like tweak the light and like change contrast. I use this app called Lapse a lot that is basically just the newest VSCO type app that you just take photos through. It will put them in a digital dark room. That's not real.
You gotta call it that.
And then like an hour later, they're ready. And then you see them and they have this beautiful filter on them. But I'm not doing any of that. And I'm only using that because it's on my phone. So it's all kind of contained in the phone. But if I was doing something more, I guess, quote unquote, professional, to your point, Mike, I'm not doing work that really lives on the phone.
I would never edit anything of import on a phone. And I made that choice in my early 20s when I already knew that I was too old for this. I would see younger musicians roll up to a gig with an iPad and unfurl an entire sequence of things. And I was like, I'm never going to learn that. I'm 22. I'm already never going to learn how to do that.
That was you are answering the question that I was going to ask next, which is, Jason, as a, like a musician, I'm curious how you feel about like iPad production, because especially in electronic music, there's like a whole class of people who like, I'm the same way. I tried. And I just, it's so foreign to me. I find it very, very hard.
And the thing is, like, it's cool when they do it. I know that I am bad for not knowing how to do this and that they are cool. But I decided very early this was not a skill I was going to pick up. And similarly, editing. I'm so amazed when Steve Lacy puts together something on his iPhone that is great. I will never learn anywhere near that skill. I went to a celebration of the closing of the comparative literature department at Hamilton College a couple years ago. And showed up with my actual real book, because there was going to be some jazz players there and I was going to play with some folks and we had a good time. And all the kids were aghast at my real book and they had never seen one in person and they all had their iPads and this was like a relic to them and they enjoyed it. It was cute that I had showed up with an actual real book and they're like, whoa, can I thumb through that?
It's a shame Hans had to leave because in the background in his studio is on his piano is a physical real book.
Yeah. It is like a pacifier to me. I need that to be able to play jazz. And I cannot wait for all the emails telling me that I am right.
Soon you'll be the one dabbing.
Yes. God willing.
We got a voicemail from Josh, a different Josh, about an experience of email that one might have had if they are slightly older.
I'm 45, and that puts me as a Gen whatever, X maybe, I guess. I'm not sure. One thing I was thinking about, I just was listening to your discussion, and I was thinking that perhaps, at least for me and maybe my wife too, we've spoken about this, that how we email and like we text as well have as much to do with our age as the tool itself. So that, for instance, text and, you know, email were a lot of fun when we first got them and it was kind of a joy. And then, you know, email is now turned into a burden and it's a thing that, you know, we get emails and we end up deleting most of them because it's crap. It's been commodified and it's been used for advertising and it's not a fun experience anymore. And that could be because it's email, or it just could be that we're a lot older. We've been doing this for, you know, 20 plus years. I wonder what that consideration is just that as we've gotten older as a people group, that we also see the tools that we use differently.
Josh's voicemail really made me like, it was like a bolt of lightning of, in fact, remembering having email for the first time. And I would say that I agree that like, I think email was fun for like a solid maybe 10 years or more.
There was a time when if you had the number that said you had unread emails, that was a good thing. You'd log on, it would take a while to get there, and if there was no new emails, you would be disappointed. Yeah. Now, it is the exact opposite.
I think I'm the exact age to have missed that.
Yeah, that's. I figured that this might be the case. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, because email always kind of was the domain of either professionalism or spam.
I mean, there was always spam, but it was of the sort that spam filters caught. It was sort of actual spam. Now we have this sort of pseudo spam that, like, everything is kind of spam, but it's also kind of an email. And so the filters don't really.
I get a lot of emails that, like, it makes sense that I get them and I understand why I'm getting them, but I want almost none of them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like a cavalcade of coupons.
Right. It's just bullshit. It's just so much bullshit. And like that, yeah, like that used to not be the case. You would only ever get emails from individual people who wanted to get a hold of you for something.
Yeah.
And at least, like, you know, when I first moved to New York, that was almost always a job, right? Like an email meant, like, someone needs me to do something that I can charge them money for, which was very, very exciting. Mm. Now it's, nonsense or someone who needs money from me, which, go away, all of you.
No.
Yeah. No, you used to go to your inbox and you'd be like, my friends and opportunities are in here.
Yeah,
exactly. And now none of that is true.
So I wonder, I mean, that's, I just wanted to pose that as, like, do we think that that is the technology or the, our age? And it seems like it's probably both.
Oh, it's definitely both.
Or one as a factor of the other. Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally, we started out talking about the listener response to important emails, acknowledging everybody who agreed with Georgia. I would also like to just blanket acknowledge everyone who wrote in, who wrote an email saying that they were writing the email on their phone, even though that didn't seem like the right thing to do, just to practice. And I just want to say, you are seen and you are appreciated.
Yes.
And you did, and you all of you did a great job.
Also, on top of that, a lot of really thoughtful emails about emails in there. And I really enjoyed reading all of them. So thank you for putting as much thought into emails as an email is supposed to have in it. I appreciate
taking your email seriously. Yes. The right amount of seriousness.
This is the real deal.
Well proportioned.
They look great.
Uh-huh.
Okay, from emails to audio, we now move on to episode 5. And the first thing we're going to talk about is Burnt Toast Audio. If you don't remember, the Burnt Toast Audio segment was about how a lot of audio online seems to be worse than it needs to be, like it's bad on purpose, and wondering why that might be. And I have some great news. Louise is back to join us as a guest. Yay!
Hi, everyone.
We flew him in from Studio Ochenta.
Yes.
All the way to the Riverside call. Louise, thank you for joining us.
Oh, of course. Thanks for having me. I was excited ever since you originally invited me to be a part of this mailbag. It's great to be here and, like, see what comes up. I'm curious and I'm excited.
Well, then, in that case, allow me to introduce you to clowns.
Yes!
Wow. Georgia, I will let you take it from here.
Oh, my God. Yeah, we got an incredible message from Dylan on, as he described it, burnt toast clowns, which, mixed feelings about that imagery, but...
I'm excited. I'm a little scared.
Yes. But yeah, they made such an interesting point about how... the use of burnt toast audio likens itself almost to clowning, and how clowning has a real place on the social internet. And even mentioned that Tierra, the TikToker that we mention, is kind of doing a performance that could be clowning, and that even Twitch streamers are clowning, which I find amazing that this person made this connection, because... Louise, as you know, the original version of the video I sent you is actually not the original version.
Of course, yeah.
It is an animated interpretation of that audio with a little cartoon clown with a microphone.
Whoa.
Yes.
There we go.
We kept calling it the clown video.
Yeah.
But Louise, I'm interested to hear your thoughts more about this idea of clowning and, like, audio clowning online.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that now that you mentioned it and I heard it, it seems so obvious, but we never really touched on it in the piece. And now I'm like so curious to just explore that a lot more because it makes a lot of sense. Like, people are afraid of clowns for so many reasons and all of that. And like the whole like clown phobia is a big thing. Right. And I feel like part of it in part, and also just everyone's discomfort, or not everyone's, but a lot of people's discomfort towards clowns and these sorts of performers, is that you never really get access to the person behind the face paint or the mask mm-hmm. or whatever. Right. And so like, they're always clowning. They're always like playing with you, and you're always the butt of the joke with them, right? And it's kind of inescapable.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's a fascinating thing to bring into this idea of audio virtuosity and clowning, in the sense of like you're always on edge because there's always something happening, and you're always sort of vulnerable to someone's mm-hmm. like mocking.
And the second part of Dylan's email is great because it talks about Dawn of Everything, the Wengrow and Graeber book, which is great. One of my favorites. Very, very good. But Dylan talks about that, like that very thing that we've maybe become a little bit too accustomed to not being uncomfortable. We're all just a little too comfortable. And clowns like bad audio push you into this perverted, right? Inversion yeah. or perversion of typical values and hierarchies. That's just like puts you on edge.
Yeah. The other interesting overlap here is that we described Burnt Toast Audio a bit as like performance art. Mm-hmm. And performance art as a medium owes a lot to clowning. And there's a large percentage of people who do performance art who have gone to clown college. This is like a known path to getting into cool performance art. As you go to clown college, you get your skills, and then you come do the weird stuff in the black boxes. So yes. Clowning's everywhere.
That is a promise and a threat. Well, this actually dovetails kind of nicely into the next comment that we got from a listener named Ian on a similar kind of challenge, like challenging through the use of Burnt Toast Audio, specifically on the limitations of audio and the format turning into its own kind of aesthetic.
I can't remember the exact quote, but Brian Eno said that every technical limitation will eventually become an aesthetic. And I've been thinking about this a lot recently because I've been working on the score to a documentary about sound and sound effects. And so I've been using the aesthetics of different eras of sound to kind of create a through line and represent those eras in, you know, just the actual content of the music. But what's so interesting about Burnt Toast Audio, or just the general fascination with kind of the early internet limitations recently, you know, especially on TikTok, is that, you know, the other one being the lossy data compression of MP3s and, you know, Kazaa downloads, things like that. What's so interesting is that it is the aesthetic of the internet that can only be used on the internet. And it's kind of like gatekeeping the gatekeepers of, you know, traditional media is not able to use this properly. You know, it sounds wrong, like you said. And so I think this is the first time that there is an actual aesthetic that can only be used by the community that created the aesthetic, at least in terms of sound. So, yeah, thanks so much. Love the show. Bye.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
I totally agree. And that is something that I have thought about for a long time. And it's a concept that that has always fascinated me. The thing about like technology, once it becomes obsolete, becomes an aesthetic. It's something that's so fascinating, of course, right? Like once vinyl records aren't the predominant form of audio listening or consumption, right? Then suddenly like having or listening to your music on vinyl becomes a choice, right? An aesthetic choice. And you also like take into account how it looks, right? And so a similar thing happens obviously with every stage of technology as it relates to art, and then in this case specifically to sound, right? I mean, not too long ago, the only way to listen to audio on the internet was through like a relatively low quality because that's all we could do, right? And so then now that that's not the only option, suddenly deciding to do it has become this aesthetic choice as well. And it's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way, about how like it's so far hasn't been able to be co-opted in some way, like beyond the internet in the quote traditional media or that sort of thing. I find that just fascinating to explore.
There are definitely ways that it's leaking in the conversation we had with Charlie Harding.
Yeah.
In the most recent episode, he was talking about how Phoebe Bridgers made choices to make her album sound more like you had gotten it off of Kazaa. And there is now a nostalgia for the limitations of MP3 and the aesthetic choice that that is, much in the way that if you get that little hiss of a vinyl record in the middle of your lo-fi beat to chill out to, you feel better. Yeah. something feels better about the MP3 limitations. And
that was my main reaction to this was, surely it's only a matter of time. Yeah, right. Right. Like, yeah,
the comforting hug of the loudness wars. but yeah, it's totally wild how like set in time by necessity technology becomes. And then of course it has to mean something. And then if you reach into the bag of meaning and try to get it, you're going to reach for the tech that gets you there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a big interest of ours exploring this kind of audio was that it was just so uniquely of the internet and seemed to kind of only be able to exist there.
Like, you are always referencing. There's no presence of it that doesn't conjure those places in some way.
Exactly. You can't, you can never extricate it from that original source.
We talked about this a little bit on our audio production stream that we did, me, Hans, and Jason, where it's like, there are plugins that let you do it, but you do it because it sounds like the internet, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Like the original purpose is still there. Well, Luis, I'm so glad you were able to come back and chat with us.
Of course. Yeah. Thanks for inviting me. Call me whenever you would like to work on anything else that's like weird audio internet stuff related. I'm here and I'd be happy to.
Those are all of our favorite words in a row. Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and on to episode 6, our most recent episode. First, we have a phone call from Steve, who, Jason, lists a bunch of things that you guys missed when talking about the sound of the internet.
Well, I asked for it, so I'm ready, Steve.
I think Lil B, the bass god, deserves an honorable mention for being one of the best, worst rappers of all time who did get his start on the internet. I think Kodak Black is kind of in that category too, though some of his more recent stuff I think is quite a bit better. XXXTentacion is in that camp too. All three of these figures are pretty fraught people. And I think that's kind of part of what makes them feel like the internet. But then there's also like Zach Fox, who's a comedy rapper, at least ostensibly, but honestly has some of the greatest bars in the game. But really I wanted to talk about JPEG Mafia, who I think sounds like if Jay Dilla grew up on Xbox Live playing Call of Duty with the rest of us. Fantastic work. I love Hazard Duty Pay, but if we're talking about stuff that sounds like the internet, super glitchy and the type of record scratch switches between genres and vibes that you might see in something like hyperpop, then you should check out his album with Danny Brown. Songs like Lean Beef Patty, Step a Pig, Kingdom Hearts Key, all these just like feel like Twitter jokes come to life, and the energy is unbelievable. Also allows me to talk about Gary Clark Jr. He's not really an internet artist, but also jumps genres in a way that feels like the internet. Thanks. Bye.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you, Steve. There was definitely a lot of hip hop that we did not get time to talk about in the timeline of this. And I think everyone you just mentioned fits really elegantly into that space of like humor, self-aware, ironic facing internet that we did talk about. And these are all like perfect. Danny Brown immediately came to mind. And I also think it's important to think about because it transitions nicely into the streamer era. Like Danny Brown now is more known for being a streamer than his musical output. If you think about what T-Pain has managed to do with his career being like maybe one of the best streamers, and how that has revitalized his image for a new generation.
I love T-Pain's journey.
I love T-Pain. I just love him. Hip hop has always been so culturally aware of its own participation in culture, even in the moment, that it is really, it's a really good lens to look at how the internet is bleeding into everyday consumer culture at the exact same time. And I think everyone you mentioned is a great part of that journey.
I love that Steve is like, I got so much to say. I'm going to name these three people. Those are the first three people that come to mind. They're all problematic.
Yes. Yeah. But that's a part of it.
Feels like the internet. And Steve, but it's you true. Are not wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's but that's so like, true.
That's SoundCloud rap. This is like a part of the history of the internet sounding music, of internet sounding music that we have to deal with.
Yeah.
I mean, also just the incredibly apt mention of Gary Clark Jr. That is such, so good. I mean, his newest album is called JPEG Raw. Mm-hmm. Even like the genre jumping and mixing and all of that. I even think of something like the mashup of Encore and Numb, the like Jay-Z Linkin Park collaboration from back in at least like my emo youth. Like that, there's so much of what is of the internet sonically and musically is this genre mixing and jumping.
Mm-hmm. And Steve wasn't the only person to point out what I missed. Ethan also wrote in an email saying that he would have liked to have heard more about Chillwave, the blog rock era, and Pitchfork, the 1975 postmodern, post-irony bands with hypertextuality in their music, Bandcamp and bedroom pop, meme genres like Simpson Wave, RYM, Mucore, The Needle Drop. I'm sorry. I agree that they should all be in there, but we only have so much time.
I'm so sorry we let the lo-fi chill hip-hop beats girl down.
So I do want to take a little bit of time for chill wave and Pitchfork stuff, though, because it was really hard for me to decide how much of Pitchfork oeuvre counts as sounding like the internet or not, just because it was so monocultural and it was in Brooklyn, it was in different scenes, and it was suggesting that it was the only important culture, but I don't actually think it was internet culture, despite the fact of the discourse proliferating on blogs. Chillwave probably has a better argument to be in the mix.
I would agree, definitely.
I agree with that. A lot of the Pitchfork stuff feels like it's media darling music that leaked into the internet, as yes. opposed to things right. that feel like they came from the internet in a more, I can't believe I'm about to say this, authentic way.
And speaking of authentic, I do think bedroom pop deserves to be in this conversation. We kind of talked about MySpace era music and sort of the emo to bedroom pop wave or crossover or trajectory or gateway or whatever it is. But clearly, you know, home production tools include that genre in a meaningful sense. And YouTube music for a very long time was sort of better produced bedroom pop, weaponized into more and more sparkling production.
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you, Ethan. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, everyone else. Please continue to tell me what I missed, because I'm also finding new stuff to listen to in here. And that is awesome.
And with that, our second mailbag episode comes to an end. A round of applause for everybody, everyone involved. Georgia, no, round of applause, not dabbing. Oh. Round of applause. She just won't stop dabbing.
At this point, this is bordering on cyberbullying.
Now she's doing the Dougie?
Oh, wait. Okay, never mind. She's doing it really well. Who said that?
Wait, could you teach me how to Dougie?
Mm.
Thank you to everyone who wrote in, who left us a voice memo, who left us a voicemail. And thank you at the same level to people who we didn't get to. It's really hard for us to get to every single thing that comes in. Please do not take the absence of your response as an indication that we did not find it interesting. It's just we get a lot and we would love to talk about it all. But we're just a small team. We're just humans. We're just
a couple of little guys.
Just a couple of little guys.
I'm just a rude little dude.
So we appreciate you and we love hearing from you. So please, write in, let us know what you think. And we'll see you at the next mailbag in three or four more episodes.
Thank you, everybody.
Cool.
Thanks,
everyone.